This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org if you're not there already. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Saul Williams. He's a multidisciplinary artist. He's a poet, first off, which is pretty high in my pantheon. He's a singer. He's a songwriter. He's an actor. He's a performance artist. He was and still is involved in a big way in the slam poetry scene and played a prominent role in the film Slam. He's made a couple of albums. He's the author of four books at least, including The Dead MC Scrolls, The Lost Teachings of Hip Hop, and Said the Shotgun to the Head. I just saw a couple of quotes from those books that were really profound and fascinating and intriguing. I wish I'd had time to read them before I got you here. His latest book of poems just came out, and it's not just his. It's called Chorus, a Literary Mixtape. Saul Williams, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a delight. You know, I've heard a lot about you, and I've seen some YouTube videos of you on the web, and we ran a YouTube video on the Progressive's website a while back, so I've always been intrigued by you here over the last couple of years. And this book, let's start with that, because I went to your website today, and I saw a posting on your blog from about a year ago giving mm-hmm. a shout-out to people, an all-call for poems from, mm-hmm. from poets you liked, and so you're going to put together an anthology. And then I get this book and I start reading. And at first it looks like it's all you because mm-hmm. there are no poets' bylines in there. And I get to the end and you write at the end of the book, "The idea of editing an anthology of modern living poets was intriguing, but not intriguing enough for one simple reason. I seldom read anthologies." but yet this is a kind of anthology. So tell me what happened.
Well, essentially, you know, I've really been lucky, blessed, however you want to call it, with, you know, my life in poetry, to travel, you know, I guess around 40 countries, speak at universities around the world and meet and interact with a lot of amazing poets, you know, and from all sorts of backgrounds, what have you, and who hand me their work and ask me to read it, ask my opinion, also ask me questions about getting published and how does one live off of poetry and all of this stuff. And for years, I've wanted to share, I guess, the opportunities that have been afforded me with so many of the poets that I've met, you know. And so the only problem was essentially that I, of course, I could do an anthology, but I don't read them.
So why don't you read them?
Because I'm more into you know, novels and complete, you know, statements in the form of books, one person's voice or what have you, you know. Like, I guess the last anthology I might have read was like the Bible. I really wanted to find a creative way of sharing these people's voices that was aligned with all of the other approaches that I've always, you know, kind of prided myself on, and always trying to find a unique approach to whether it's recording an album or putting out a book or what have you. And so I had the epiphany of putting out a call through social media. As you said, you saw it on my website. I did that last year. And asking poets to send me poems for me to conduct a little experiment. Over the course of a month, I received about 8,000 poems. Wow. From that, I first decided that it was time to hire two friends of mine, two writer friends, Aja Monet and Dufflin Lammers, to work as assistant editors with me and to help me select 100 poems. Once I had 100 poems, I then took the titles off of the poems and the names of the authors off of the poems, and then printed them all out, just the text. And I hung them around my house like wallpaper.
And why'd you do it that way?
Because I had an idea that there would possibly be a way of fusing 100 voices together as if they were one. And the first thing I discovered was that the titles were distracting. But if I just dealt with the text itself, it was easy to see how one form of text might connect with another one. A stupid or simple way of looking at it could be, but easy to imagine, would be like if you had a poem that ended, "And then I climbed to the top of the mountain," and a poem that began, "While standing on top of the mountain, I began to think, blah, 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 blah." So, okay, well, that could go. But actually, the connections that I made were more thematic, you know, than just words connecting like that. But I had this, you know, belief in me the same way that I would have if I bought a puzzle with 1,000 pieces and it had a picture on top and I took the lid off the box and took 1,000 pieces off out of the box. It might be difficult, but I'd know that they'd all fit together. And then somehow I felt that these 100 pieces would all fit together too. I did not ask writers to write about any specific topic or subject or what have you. So the first thing that was going on when I was going through the 8,000 poems was that I felt like I was in a unique position of being able to really gauge the temperature or state of a generation, so to speak. The range of ages were primarily between 16 and 24. And 8,000 poems, just kids writing about whatever they want to.
What is that, you know, temperature?
It was primarily questions of identity. It all surrounded questions of identity, primarily, you know, whether it was the idea of racial identity, social, sexual, gender, religious, national, class-specific. But either way, it was people who felt as if they had been born in boxes that they were trying to escape. The majority of the voices were women. The majority of the voices were angry, and extremely articulate. And so it took me about 6 months of, like, you know, waking up, reading, sleeping, eating, reading, sleeping, you know, and eventually thinking this would be a great first poem and starting to order the poems on my wall until I had 100 in an order that felt like a singular sort of expression. Once I did that, then I wanted to contribute. And so then what I did was I then, with the sequence that I had chosen and restricting myself to the other poets' writing, I then highlighted words in all of their poems in sequence in order to write a poem over their poem.
Oh, so is that what's going on with these light-colored words?
That's what the light-colored words are. So the book insists that you read it twice. First, you read the poems of the other people in that order, and they're just separated by numbers with the poets and the titles of their poems listed in the back like film credits. And then you can go through and read all the light words, and that's one poem that goes over all of the poems through the course of the book.
So it's interesting. On the first page, there's a poem, and inside the poem there's a three-line verse that says, elevating a combination of mundane thoughts to the epic, and that's in lighter type than the rest of the poem. And then you can find on page 3, there are another 3 lines, which I can't read.
Which you can't say on the radio. That was the other thing, is that, you know, I found a lot of the voices were, you know, going through this sort of internal dialogue or discourse between the idea of the sacred and the profane, which is to say that there's a lot of profanity. But what's interesting about the profanity that is in there is that it all circles around the idea of and the question of what do we hold sacred?
Right.
What do we hold sacred? What exactly is sacred about this? And what exactly is profane about what you have labeled profane? And I thought that was important, too, because, you know, like when you get used to the whole, like you said, you know, like we have so many restrictions on radio, on TV, everything's so whitewashed and what have you. And I start looking forward to trash. I'm like, where is the punk rock nowadays? Why is everybody so afraid of this? And yeah, you can hear it in hip hop or what have you. But there, most of the stuff that I hear may sound trashy, but ideologically, it's not necessarily punk. It's actually more conformist, aligned with very capitalistic ideals and values that I don't really value.
And a lot of the poems here are rebelling against that.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. So there's a lot of rebellion in there.
And I love that. I mean, I love that there's this poem, Kevin Koval's poem of... and I got to say, I laughed out loud when I got to this line.
He was at the reading last night and he read. Yeah, but go ahead. Yeah.
I can't read this whole poem either, but the line that made me just laugh out loud was, we want poems that tie Billy Collins to a chair and beat him.
Isn't that great? I was like,
no,
yes.
I'm not for violence, but I did sit through a reading by Billy Collins that was attended by an enormous crowd of 1,000 people in Madison, Wisconsin, who were just in love with it. And I was just, I hated it. And I hated it because I thought it was so light and frothy and meaningless, ultimately.
Where is the rebellion? Yeah. Where is, you know, like, the reason why this book is called Chorus is because it's aligned with the idea of the Greek chorus in the ancient Greek tragedies. And in those plays, the chorus was the voice of dissent, the voice of the people, the voice of democracy, the voice of God, the voice of reason, you know? But I underline the voice of dissent, you know? And I think that that's crucial. Mm-hmm. I think that that's crucial in this day and age. You know, there's another poem. It might be that same Kevin Koval poem, you know, that talks about occupying the imagination, you know. And I always see that, you know, poetry, it gets popular in cycles.
Right.
You know, like, we wouldn't have had a civil rights movement if it weren't preceded by the Harlem Renaissance that preceded it. We wouldn't have had a hippie movement in the 60s if it wasn't preceded by the beat poets that preceded it. We wouldn't have had a black power movement if it wasn't preceded by the black arts movement. Mm. And I would say that we wouldn't have an Occupy movement or a Barack Obama and all that stuff if it wasn't preceded by the slam movement. Mm. You know, when there's something about when young people get together and rediscover their connection to language, rediscover their power to speak up, and realize that they can, through voicing their ideas, their opinions, shift us. That's what the age of transparency and all of these people coming out of the closet and out of the woodwork is about. You know, I saw all these people coming out in poetry readings in the 90s before they were doing it, you know, on TV and on the internet now. Talking about bullying and all this stuff. It was all happening. That was the dialogue that was going on in poetry readings in the 90s.
I'm speaking with Saul Williams. He's my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. It must have been fascinating to be right in the midst of the spoken word revolution.
Yeah, it was. It was, and it is, essentially, because what people, you know, didn't know, and maybe I'm not sure how well things like Deaf Poetry Jam or whatever documented it, was that, you know, unlike hip-hop, which was primarily initially from, you know, the urban community and represented the disenfranchised and you know, like, young black youth, unlike that, the... essentially, the poetry movement itself was always diverse. That's what excited me about it from the beginning, is that it was always a spectrum of different, you know, people with different social status, different race, different ideologies. It was always that you had some people who would come there, yes, inspired by hip hop. Other people would come there inspired by Utah Phillips and Anita Franco, right, or what have you, and some leftover beat poets who were old who would be there as well. So that it had all types of age demographics and all that, and it continues to do that. And what I'm referencing is like my time at the New Eurekan, right, Poets Cafe and the Bowery Poetry Club in New York and the Brooklyn Moon Cafe. It was always diverse. And that's what's wonderful about, you know, the poetry movement. And now it's you know, it's 15 and 14-year-olds. There's programs like Youth Speaks and Brave New Voices where thousands of kids gather from across the world and do this kind of like lyrical skateboarding. You know, voicing their opinions and really speaking up. It's powerful.
It's powerful, and it's liberating politically and probably personally too. But it's also liberating in an academic way, because the academic, the academy has its own closets.
Yeah.
Its own poetry closets.
Yeah. And its own class system as well, you know. And that's been part of my career, essentially, is that I have found it really important to, you know, I'm someone who had a bizarrely nuanced sort of upbringing. My father was a Baptist pastor. My mother was a school teacher. We lived deep in the hood, and all of the congregants at my father's church, you know, came from the projects that surrounded it and what have you. If we were middle class, it was simply because people tithed and gave offerings, you know, and so we were like the representatives of that, but we were in the middle of it.
Where'd you grow up?
Newburgh, New York.
Your dad was an opera singer too,
trained. Yeah, my father trained as an opera singer. He used to be on a show when he was 8-9 years old called Star Time Kids, which was on back in the late 40s, early 50s. And then he went to the School of Music and Art in New York, which became LaGuardia, which is what the film Fame and all that is based on. And then he was called into the ministry when he was 19. And from that point forward, he was you know, preaching and what have you. But he came from that time when the church was really aligned with the civil rights movement. So my father and mother were both activists in the civil rights struggle. And, you know, I grew up literally, Pete Seeger, for example, was a member of my father's church. Huh. He would sing at my father's church on a regular basis. And I'd be like, what is this boring white man doing singing school songs, you know, at church? And then one day, much older, I looked at, like, if I had a hammer or something, and it was like, by Pete Seeger. I was like, oh my God.
There's a new book out, a collection of his writings, a kind of an autobiography that was put together just from his files.
Yep.
It's really fascinating.
No, I grew up with Pete Seeger at my house for dinner, singers like Odetta. I grew up with all of that. And so what we were talking about, the academic world, you know, right. And so I grew up with a sense of, on one hand, the importance of aligning artistic expression with the quote-unquote movement, with class struggle, with conscious struggle and what have you. Also, the importance of education was impressed upon me, but I grew up in the hood and I was a rapper and a breakdancer. And so my career has really been about fusing what I love from the streets with what I see as necessary in the academic world and trying to bridge gaps so that teachers have tools that can excite their kids.
Right.
Most of my books have been about that. Like, yeah, my background's in hip hop, but I have my MFA and all this stuff. And I grew up studying Shakespeare, and I'm going to show you how what's in your canon is related to what's happening on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, we were just talking about that today at the Progressive. You know, if you had to introduce young people to the history of African American liberation movement in the United States, I don't know today if you'd start with Invisible Man or something, or you'd just take a James Baldwin essay of Letter to My Nephew, or a June Jordan poem,
or some James Brown mixtape.
Yeah, or some of the other stuff you're working on now. So you're kind of a preacher still yourself, wouldn't you say?
I mean, as long as you separate it from the idea of organized religion, then I'll accept it.
And what's your take on organized religion?
I think that organized religion can be a beautiful and necessary disciplinary crutch that people can use to align themselves with their understanding of humanity, God, each other. And I think it can be really useful. It's been really useful for me, the texts that come from these ancient texts. But I did say that it's a necessary, beautiful crutch. And I'll give it this, you know, a beautiful crutch with like marble columns on the side and beautiful stained glass panels where that gap is. But I do know that you never say, first of all, that you belong to your crutches. Your crutches belong to you. And so I think we have to keep religion in perspective. I'm not talking about God. I'm talking about religion, the man-made aspects of spirituality, right? And then I would say that, well, you know, after 2,000 years of us seeing the ramifications of one religion and now stepping into the ramifications of another religion, I would say that, well, if we deal with those crutches, if we can keep it in perspective, we must realize that essentially, if you've ever broken a leg, a knee, an ankle, a foot, you know there's a point when your doctor says to you, well, you may not feel ready, but it's time to take the cast off, and you're going to need to practice walking without crutches so the muscles can develop properly. Mm-hmm. If not, you never walk on your own again properly. And so I think it's about time for people to let go of their crutches.
And do you have arguments with your father on that? Is your father still around?
No, my father died. I killed him. No.
If he had heard that, he would have died again, probably.
No. The greatest thing is my father had the best sense of humor, and so I feel really lighthearted when I talked about all this stuff, because my dad may have been firm in his beliefs, but he was great at laughing, you know, and he was really open. And I was able to dialogue about my epiphanies and ideas and revelations as I was growing up with my dad. I remember, you know, I would sit in a room with my father with like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and Louis Farrakhan. Mm. That's a day in my father's office.
Boy, I'd have loved to have been on the wall there.
And I'm 14 years old. And that was, I remember that, that's like Tawana Brawley. That you remember that court case that happened where I grew up. And I would be there, like, they would say a prayer before they'd go out into the rally, and I'd be there holding one hand Jesse Jackson, one hand Louis Farrakhan, and they're praying, and I'm comparing the size of each man's rings, you know? And then I'd be in the room with my father with other ministers, and they'd be discussing stuff like whether they would allow a woman to preach on their pulpit. All right? because it was the advent of a lot of female ministers. Mm-hmm. And so here were these conservative, you know, men saying, well, I don't know, not in my church. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. And I was the 14-year-old kid who'd be like, you're stupid. You're silly. And I was never like, they were never like, respect your elders. They were like, ah, you don't understand. I was like, no, you don't understand. You're caught up in something that's not even related to your religion. Well, it's related to your religion, but it's not related to the red letters in your Bible. Right. You know,
values they're espousing. My fascinating guest today is Saul Williams. He is a poet. He's a musician. He's an actor. He's been one of the revolutionaries of the spoken word movement. And we're talking about a lot of things today, which is fun. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. We kicked it off by talking about his latest book, which is called Chorus, a Literary Mixtape. And it is a fascinating volume of 100 different poets that Saul Williams has put together without their titles and their bylines up front. And you just read through it. And there's wrestling with God in here. There's wrestling with religion in here.
Exactly. Exactly that. And so there's a lot of, you know, maybe pedestrian, poets. But there's probably about 20 well-regarded poets in there as well. And so that's also cool, too, is to, like, match these worlds up, the canon, along with, you know, these kids who just love poetry, you know. And so it's a fun collection.
It's also nice to find new people that you didn't know about.
We
publish one original poem every month in the Progressive, and sometimes it's just someone I never heard of, and then, you know, we pass the poetry around and see who likes it, and we can make a case, and boom, this goes just as well as the next one by Mary Oliver, you know. So you know, everyone's got a place, and it should be a bit of a democracy. There's a lot about poetry here too, about poetry, the role of poetry. Someone says poetry is a pen to sew with, or I need a pen to sew with. And there's one line also in here, Alex Jones, I think, hope can elect a president, but it can't save a person's life. So we write and read poems like these lighthouses. I love that line.
Mm-hmm.
I love the whole poem, which is about saving someone's life, not writing a poem about after someone's dead, but, you know, kind of, you know, the lost lamb, the person who's, you know, was great in high school and then just kind of lost his or her way. And
we all know
those great poems.
And
it's a real powerful poem. But also this is a poem about poetry.
Yep.
And so can poetry save a person's life?
Definitely. I mean, I can speak to you on many levels from personal experiences. One of the most crucial experiences early in my career was an email that I got on my website. This is way back, like maybe 2000, from a mother who told me that her son had been in a horrendous car accident. He was a rapper before then, and that now he was, you know, he had been in a coma, and that finally they had retrieved the car and gone through it, and they had found my CD in the car and decided to play it in the hospital, my first CD, Amethyst Rockstar. And when they started, his sister started playing the CD in the hospital, and he woke from his coma. And slowly started regaining consciousness and started working through. He still is in a wheelchair and what have you, but he started gaining access to his body and what have you and singing along. And his mother wrote me this beautiful thank you note. His name is Matt. I ended up meeting him and, you know, flying to D.C. and what have you. and that's one example.
So that literally saved his life.
Yeah, well, it definitely, helped, you know. I think that poetry is crucial to so many people. One of the things that was alarming when I was going through the original 8,000 poems is that, you know, people write poetry for different reasons. Some are in love with language. Some are working through emotions and you know, out of necessity. And the amount of abuse that I found kids working through, whether it was molestation, violence, you know, bullying, what the amount of abuse. And poetry, partially, I think, is often there and easily accessible for that.
An antidote to that.
Yep, an antidote for that, exactly. And so I think that people find it really helpful In that sense, of course, people can also find it really boring. And so,
but then you just need to keep looking because there's so much exciting things going on in poetry.
Oh, my God. Right now. Yeah. There's, you know, some of the most irreverent, crazy voices I've ever heard are the voices of poets, you know, whether we're talking about Ginsberg and his, you know, prime or people like Hafiz or Rumi, this old Sufi poets and the crazy stuff they would say, you know, like, God needs to stop standing on the table and lifting her skirt. I'm tired of looking up there. That's Hafiz, you know what I'm saying? That's 1200, you know what I'm saying? That's written in 1200. There's so much amazing voices, and so many amazing voices, and really powerful, powerful.
I'm speaking with Saul Williams, who's a poet himself and is the author of this anthology, or the curator of this anthology.
Yeah.
I don't know quite how to put it. It's called Chorus, a literary mixtape. We only have a few minutes left. I'd love it if you could perform one of your poems. Is there something you want to read or perform? Or
give
people a flavor of the kind of work that you do?
You know what? I'll read a journal entry.
That
How about that? You know, we'll keep it really simple.
And sometimes journal entries are the first stages of poems.
Yeah, exactly. So this is an unedited poem, a journal entry. Some thoughts travel from distant places, are not born within our borders, and must pass through heightened security, fortified by age-old tradition, the norms of societal culture, the misgivings of prejudice and misplaced judgment in order to arrive peacefully in our minds. Our minds are high-walled fortresses where security councils gather to preserve comfort, enforce what we have been taught to value and discern and determine what is real. We depend on our minds to guide and aid us from one day to the next. Some of us see our minds like muscles that we exercise with theorems, riddles, thoughts, and thought processes. We gather and store information. We play word games, rap, solve problems, work to the best of our abilities. We also accept or reject labels and categorizations at face value. Black, white, terrorist, suspect, gay, straight, religious, Republican. We sometimes choose lifestyles based upon those accepted labels and categorizations, those that we identify with, which then take the form of beliefs. Beliefs are the police of the mind. They are either uniformed or universal, armed or unarmed. They hold the power to confiscate material they consider hazardous or incredible. They profile experience and information as nonsense. Get out of here. They convene regularly with the Thought Security Council and act according to their constitution of what is real or unreal, possible or impossible, and they are sometimes and often mistaken. My question to you today is, what is your mind's immigration policy? Do you detain foreign thoughts that may have entered your mind illegally against the wishes of your parents, pastors, teachers, leaders, or perhaps simply against the security of your own comfort? Are there other thoughts that you have perhaps allowed to go unchecked, unquestioned, because they seem aligned with your so-called identity? Are you certain that you are not a victim of identity fraud?
Mm-hmm. And that is a journal entry by Saul Williams, who's reading it himself. Not many people's journal entries are so heavy or so poetic, I don't think. But beliefs are the police of the mind. I love that. I love that. And so you'll turn that into a song or a poem at some point?
There's a possibility. There's a song I'm working on called F the Beliefs.
Well, I think that one would fit in pretty well there. And, you know, I just have had so much fun reading Chorus, a literary mixtape, and also just getting to know you a little bit in preparation for this interview, but mostly just sitting here talking one-on-one.
Saul
Williams, it's been a real pleasure having you here on Progressive Radio. And I recommend to you, the listener, if you're in your car, I hope you're not crashing, if you're in your kitchen or at your workplace, to check out Saul Williams. And I'll be back next week with another guest.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.